In his new memoir, James Wolcott writes, "How lucky I was, arriving in New York just as everything was about to go to hell." He goes on to capture what it was like working at the Village Voice in its heyday, meeting the renowned film critic Pauline Kael, who became his mentor, and being a part of the legendary music scene at CBGB. Lucking out, my life, getting down and semi-dirty in 70s New York is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Wolcott to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
Didn't you grow up in Maryland near Baltimore?
I did grow up in northeast of Baltimore, near a military base called Edgewood Arsenal, did a lot of chemical research. And it turns up in books, histories of LSD research, although we didn't know that at the time.
Is that why you decided to move to New York instead of Washington, D.C.?
No, it was that New York just seemed to be the journalistic center. It was the writing center. And, I always sort of had my eyes pointed northward.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, if you wanted to make it as a writer or an artist, you had to come to New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, two of my models were John Boy Walton from Walton's Mountain, that show, The Waltons. And he came to New York eventually. He wanted to be the next Thomas Wolfe. And there was also a movie called Young Blood Hawk, which was also about a Thomas Wolfe character, the old Thomas Wolfe, not the Tom Wolfe, the journalist. And there was this sense of, like, you came from the provinces to the city, and then it was all there before you.
Well, why do you feel that you were lucky to arrive in New York just as people felt everything was about to go to hell? Did you feel that at the time?
I felt it at the time only because everyone was saying it, and also what I saw around me was so deteriorating and chaotic. But at the same time, I didn't know any other New York. I didn't have an experience or a picture in my head of New York in the 50s or even the early 60s. So to me, it was crumbling, and it was noisy and chaotic and nasty, but that was the only reality I was knowing. And so, it was like you just adapted to it.
Well, in retrospect, it looks like a transitionary period, just as the post-war period was transitionary. And the New York we know today grew out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it almost would have had to have gone through something like that.
Yes. Well, there was economic convulsions, and there were artistic convulsions. And a lot of things that happened in the 70s built on things that were in the 60s. Andy Warhol being a very, prodigious figure and prodigious influence.
But you describe discovering the work of Norman Mailer as a wow moment. What was it about his writing that had so much importance for you?
There was so much energy in it. It was also, he wasn't just writing something. He was taking on the world, and he was making himself an actor in the world. The first thing I ever read of Mailer's was The Armies of the Night, and that's where he writes about his arrest at the March on the Pentagon. And he writes about himself from the outside. He doesn't say, I do this. It was, he makes himself the character. And I thought, that's really just a wonderful way to do it, because he's facing all these different forces, but he isn't adopting the detachment of so many writers.
Did you ever meet Mailer? Because that's the way he was.
I was in rooms with Mailer, and I saw him, I saw him engaging. I saw him sparring. I didn't see Mailer at his most contentious, where you would hear things about. I tell a story in the book. I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but where he went up to Pauline Kael at a party and wanted to headbutt. Now, the idea that you would headbutt this tiny woman, but Norman Mailer was very much into headbutting. And, of course, he headbutted Gore Vidal before the Dick Cavett show. That was one of the incidents.
Yeah, but she was a bit into headbutting. When she came on the show, the only time she ever came on the show, I quite innocently asked her about her review of Shoah, which was very controversial. She did not like the film. Mm-hmm. And she said, Jim Hoberman put you up to this. And I didn't even know that his name was Jim. I just knew him as Jay Hoberman. I read sometimes in the Village Voice. He definitely had not put me up to it. And then as she walked out, she said, he wouldn't have talked to me in that way if I were a man, which, of course, wasn't true either.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know if you ever went to screenings with Pauline, because you were a friend, but she would groan and moan as if she said, oh, God, not this. And then at the end of the film, she would give a thumbs up or a thumbs down, so everybody would know what she thought and knew what the official line was.
Well, I talk about in the book the first time I was in Pauline's presence, and I didn't know her at that time. It was a screening of a movie. It was the movie Lenny, directed by Bob Fosse. And I wasn't sure what was happening, but it all of a sudden got very quiet, and I realized Pauline and, you know, her group had entered the room, and they were in the back. And all through the screening, I could hear her pencil moving, and people were aware of the pencil moving because they were thinking, what is she writing? What notes is she taking? Is she going to bring, you know? So, I mean, she was definitely a dramatic presence in the screening room.
And she had followers who came to be known as the Paulettes. Were you a Paulette?
Yes, I would say that I was definitely a Paulette.
And she insisted that people shared her aesthetics.
No, I wouldn't say that was true. There were people whose aesthetics were very different from hers. I think what she wanted them to share was a certain enthusiasm, a certain gusto. She didn't like people who were lukewarm, who were wishy-washy. You know, she wanted people who were sort of on, you know, turned on.
So have you read the new book?
I haven't. I've only looked at it. I was interviewed for it. I'm going to get to it. I was so busy with my own book, but I'm certainly, you know, aware of the reviews.
Getting back to Mailer, you sent him an article you'd written for your college newspaper about an episode on the Dick Cavett Show in which he'd appeared. Did you expect to hear back from him?
No, because all I did was I took an address that I found in Who's Who, and I thought, well, maybe he'll read it and file it away. And so when I got a reply, I mean, I was totally floored. I mean, I was in, you know, my dorm at in Frostburg State College.
And what did he tell you?
He said, I think you have a career. He said, I think you have a talent. And he offered to write a letter of recommendation for me to Dan Wolfe, who was then the editor of the Village Voice. Mailer was one of the co-founders of the Village Voice. He wasn't connected with it at that time. And what I realized was, I was a sophomore then, I thought, if I wait, I won't do it. I'll lose my nerve. You know, by the time I graduate, Mailer may have moved on. He may have forgotten. I've got to, like, try to get him to do it now. And he did.
And you dropped out of college and came to New York?
Yeah, I left after my sophomore year. I worked a summer in a biomedical lab in Edgewood Arsenal, and then I came to New York.
And did they hire you right away at the Village Voice?
No, I had to really hang around, loiter, and it wasn't until I actually was packed to leave, because I had been there for weeks. I had no money. I was in a hotel room, and I called the Voice and said, well, I just want to leave a forwarding address because I've really run out. And Dan Wolfe said, oh, all right, come on down. I think we'll find something for you. And so they found me a little job in the circulation department.
But not long after, the paper was in complete turmoil.
Yes. I started writing for it, and then there was the big takeover of by Clay Felker, and it was a complicated deal. And it caused not only internal convulsions but resentment, because a lot of people at The Voice realized that Dan and the publisher, Ed Fancher, you know, had done pretty well from the paper. But at the same time, they were like twin patriarchal figures. The only thing I can compare it to was The New Yorker when William Shawn left. A lot of people were bereft, bitter. They didn't get over it. There was a famous incident where Ron Rosenbaum, who had started under Dan Wolfe, crumbled up his paycheck, went into Clay Felker's office and threw it at him.
And was Clay Felker's impact similar to what Tina Brown's was at The New Yorker?
They did share a sensibility. Of course, we didn't know Tina was, you know, going to wing her way at some point, but it was very much because New York Magazine was more service-oriented. Clay Felker wanted pieces that were much more self-packaged. In other words, it isn't just a writer sitting down, and here's what I think based on what somebody said to me at a bar. The Village Voice ran a lot of first-person pieces. He said, no, there's got to be a specific tack to this piece. It's got to have a peg. It's got to be newsy. It can't just be. And
so he was moving it away from the new journalism, the so-called new journalism.
Yeah, he was moving away from the new journalism. But it actually revitalized The Voice, because The Voice had become sort of chatty and internal and incestuous. He brought a lot of people in who were there for years. So the paper actually, I think, got better.
And it didn't hurt that he gave you a better job. You began writing reviews.
Yes, he actually, under Clay, I was actually paid a stipend, which I believe was $200 a week. That must have been it. And, you know, a stipend to write. And the great thing was, as I talk about in the book, I actually had my own office. I mean, to have your own office as a writer was just incredible.
And you said you also discovered that you had an asset you'd never realized you had before, your name. People assumed that you were not some kid from Baltimore?
No, my name sounded sort of vaguely English. It sounded very adult. It sounded very authoritative. And of course, underneath it, I was cobbling things together with, you know, I mean, the gaps in my knowledge were, you know, like the Grand Canyon. But when the piece was published, it looked as if, well, he really knows what he's talking about.
And then you weren't just writing about films.
No, I was doing a lot of rock reviews. I was writing about television. I eventually became the television critic. I did books. The great thing about The Voice then was they didn't slot you. It wasn't like, this is what you do and this is all you can do. You can't, you know, branch out.
You're calling the book Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. My guest, by the way, is James Wolcott. The book is published by Doubleday. Semi-dirty because you got part of the – because you became part of the punk scene?
Well, semi-dirty because I became part of the punk scene. But at the same time, for example, I never did drugs. I have no drug history. I have no great history of being dissolute.
Planning to run for president?
Well, I'm sure there are other things that would disqualify me. But you know, I was never – when I see movies about the 70s and they have the swing clubs and, you know, the promiscuity and all that – you know, I was very much I was more of an observer. And so I never was like in the orgy room or Plato's Retreat or anything like that.
You were there as a reporter.
Well, that's what I told myself, you know.
but you were witness to a number of very interesting things, like the night when Bob Dylan went backstage to see Patti Smith after she had appeared in The Other End.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. he encouraged her.
It was sort of like he was giving his benediction, because Patty was a huge Dylan fan. She quoted Dylan. She modeled her look on Dylan to a certain extent. You know, she not only Dylan's music was not only important, but his persona and his look, you know. And so for him to show up, you know, first of all, Bob Dylan doesn't go to that many things, you know. And for him to go to a small room and then have his picture taken with her afterwards, say hello. That was a big deal then.
There were a lot of bands that became famous. Mm-hmm. Television, Debbie Harry as Blondie, the Ramones, David Byrne, Talking Heads.
Mm-hmm.
A few of them have continued to maintain careers. David mm-hmm. Byrne, I saw a piece of his in a museum in Germany, mm-hmm. of all things, or was it in France? But many of them have just disappeared. Do you think has the world moved on totally from what was really important in the 70s?
Well, the world has moved on, but also, you know, there's always a high drug casualty rate in any music scene, and punk in particular had a high one. I always remember, you know, I always think that at least three of the four original Ramones are all dead. The original drummer maybe still be alive, I'm not sure, but the three major figures of the Ramones all died. A lot of people died off, but at the same time, I mean, Patti Smith is now the patron saint of, you know, lower Bohemia and
author of a bestseller
and doing art things all over the world. David Byrne, as you say, David Byrne is just, he's become this Renaissance man.
Lester Bangs did die young. He was an influential figure at the
yes.
time. And how did he die?
He died. They think it was a Darvon overdose. Lester had really beaten the worst of his drugs. He did a lot of drugs. And Lester was someone like he would never take one or two pill if he could take three or four. So he had a huge appetite. So when he got off the worst of the drugs, I think his system was still much weaker than he thought. And he died in his sleep. I mean, he died, I think, asleep on his couch
at a young age. A lot of people are nostalgic about the music and art scene of the 70s. Do you think that they're romanticizing it?
Well, I think there is a romanticization involved. But, I mean, it was genuinely exciting. The problem is if you romanticize it to the point where you don't move forward. You know, there's certain things that I don't romanticize anymore that I used to. I have no interest. The Paris of the 20s, I feel, okay, we've had that. All right.
Woody made the movie already.
Woody made the movie. We don't really, Hemingway, Fester, yeah, we get all that. And there is, you know, you do feel like the scavenging of the Warhol myth has left nothing, you know, there's nothing left from that.
What about gentrification? You write about living in the far West Village and then the East Village mm-hmm. before they became gentrified. Now we have Williamsburg moving in to Greenpoint and to mm-hmm. Bushwick and also Long Island City. So is this a continual process in New York?
I think it is.
Harlem and Bed-Stuy?
Everything keeps getting pushed further out from Manhattan and it makes it – I mean, I do anticipate that maybe 15, 20 years from now, we're going to have people writing memoirs about Bushwick, you know, and the incredible, you know, artistic ferment there. I mean, I don't know about it, but I – but the people who are younger now, that may be their future.
Visit Greenpoint Avenue. It's really interesting. Manhattan Avenue. For many years, you've been a columnist, now a blogger for Vanity Fair. Does that feel like home for you?
Vanity Fair? Oh, definitely. I've been at Vanity Fair for – oh, two decades, 3 decades. I've been there
After you left the Village Voice?
Well, there was I was at New York Magazine in between, but I was at Vanity Fair in the early 80s. I was actually there before Tina Brown arrived, and I actually managed to survive the purge, the blood on the walls, the weeping in the corridors. And so I've been there mostly since the 80s.
You've also written a novel and a book on the media. And now this memoir. Mm-hmm. So you have some time on your hands.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that time on your hands is a good time to regroup. I don't want to be one of those people who frets about, well, now what do I do? It is nice actually having a book out.
And the latest book is Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. It is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being on our show, James Walcott.
Thank you.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milner, pot of thieves, wild cord of my sleeve, thick.